From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And I'm here going before the clemency board about my brother Troy Anthony Davis, who's on Georgia's death row, where 7 of 9 of his witnesses have recanted and said that he's innocent and another person has committed this crime.
Martina Correa's brother, Troy Anthony Davis, is scheduled to be executed Tuesday evening unless the Georgia Parole Board commutes his sentence. The 38-year-old African-American has been on death row for more than 15 years for the murder of a white police officer. He says he didn't commit the crime. Two of his jurors have now joined the call for his life to be spared. Then, after Senator Lieberman calls for a possible U.S. military strike on Iran, one woman went on hunger strike in order to meet him.
I'm fasting because I want to meet with Lieberman because I've been to Iran and he's threatened to use military action against Iran. And it's a beautiful country.
Leslie Angeline of Code Pink met with Senator Lieberman on the 24th day of her hunger strike. She brought with her Ali Nasri, a young Iranian who happened to be in Washington, D.C., with a group of 13 other Iranians cycling the country for peace. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 80 people have died in a pair of suicide bombings in the northern city of Kirkuk. Another 136 people were wounded in the massive blasts. One of the bombs targeted an office of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the party of Iraqi President Jalal Talabani. Witnesses said the bombings destroyed more than 20 cars and caused two buildings to completely collapse. The death toll is expected to rise. The Los Angeles Times is reporting nearly half of all foreign militants targeting U.S. troops in Iraq have come from Saudi Arabia, one of Washington's closest allies in the Middle East. Of the 19,000 prisoners being held by the U.S. in Iraq, only 135 are foreign-born fighters, and half of them are Saudi. U.S. officials have so far refused to publicly criticize Saudi Arabia's role in Iraq. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Democratic-led Senate has unanimously passed a resolution sponsored by independent Senator Joe Lieberman to censure not Saudi Arabia, but Iran for complicity in the killing of U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Lieberman said the Senate has a, quote, choice between turning a blind eye to the murder of our troops and confronting those who are murdering them. Two more media workers have been killed in Iraq. An Iraqi reporter working for the New York Times named Khaled Hassan was shot dead on Friday. He was 23 years old. Gunmen also killed an Iraqi translator working for the Reuters news agency. A total of 3 Reuters staffers have been killed in Iraq in the past week. Last Thursday, Reuters photographer Namir Nur Eldin and driver Saeed Shmagh, 40 years old, were killed in what witnesses said was a U.S. helicopter attack. Meanwhile, a top advisor to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has accused U.S. forces of human rights violations in part for carrying out bombing raids that have killed innocent civilians. Hassan al-Sunaid also criticized the U.S. for arming former Sunni insurgent groups in an attempt to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq. This comes as the U.S. continues to intensify its air war in Iraq. The Associated Press reports the Air Force and Navy aircraft dropped 5 times as many bombs in the first 6 months of this year as it did in the same period in 2006. The Air Force has also been expanding its air bases in Iraq and adding entire squadrons of attack planes to its fleet in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Air Force is preparing to start using a new robotic fighter jet in Iraq known as the Reaper. The AP describes the Reaper as a hunter-killer drone that can be operated by remote control from thousands of miles away. In news from North Korea, inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency have confirmed Pyongyang has shut down its nuclear reactor. This is the IAEA's Mohammed El-Baradei.
Yes, the Yongbyon reactor has been shut down. We verified the shutdown of the reactor. We are going through verifying the shutdown of the other facilities. And by tomorrow, after tomorrow, we will be able to report, hopefully, that all the 5 facilities have been shut down.
North Korea has closed the reactor as part of an oil for disarmament deal. In Pakistan, more than 70 people died over the weekend as pro-Taliban militants carried out a series of suicide attacks in the northwest frontier. The killings marked an end to a 10-month truce between tribal leaders and General Musharraf's government. Russia has suspended a key Cold War arms control treaty, in part to protest U.S. plans to build a missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic. The 1990 Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty limits the number of heavy weapons deployed between the Atlantic Ocean and the Ural Mountains. This is Poland's Deputy Foreign Minister Witold Waczkowski.
The CFE is one of the foundation of the situation which was created after the end of the Cold War. And we, of course, would like to keep it, this treaty, of course, with some amendments, some modification which were discussed and was implemented some years ago. But, of course, we wouldn't like to pull out from the treaty. We wouldn't like Russia to pull out from this treaty.
Russia's decision comes 5 years after the Bush administration withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. In Egypt, an international human rights delegation, including former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, has been blocked from attending a trial of 40 members of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood is the most powerful opposition group in Egypt, but is still considered an illegal organization. This is Ramsey Clark.
And it's pitiful to see a great people like the Egyptian people with a government so afraid of its own position and power that it continuously persecutes the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's highly political, obviously.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Here in this country, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles has agreed to pay at least $660 million to 500 victims of sexual abuse dating back as far as the 1940s. The settlement is the largest in any Roman Catholic diocese. Attorney Ray Boucher said the final payment could be even larger.
At this time, we're still working on trying to get the cases resolved. If we are able to get them resolved, it'll be the $600 million figure that's been talked about is not an accurate number. It should be significantly above that number.
Overall, the Catholic Church in the United States has so far paid more than $2 billion in settlements and legal judgments to victims of sexual abuse and their families. Cardinal Mahoney of the Los Angeles Archdiocese issued an apology Sunday.
One thing I wish I could give the victims, I cannot, and that is a restoration to where they were originally.
In news from Washington, President Bush is threatening to veto a bill that would extend health insurance to an additional 3.3 million low-income children. Last week, senators reached a bipartisan agreement to add $35 billion to the Children's Health Insurance Program over the next 5 years by increasing federal taxes on cigarettes. Senators say the extra funding would help cover some of the nation's 8 million uninsured children. But on Saturday, the White House said President Bush would veto the bill. In economic news, the NAACP has filed a class action lawsuit against 14 subprime mortgage lenders, alleging they engaged in institutionalized systematic racism. Lenders named in the suit include Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Washington Mutual. The National Community Reinvestment Coalition recently found African Americans are twice as likely as white applicants to receive loans with expensive above-market rates. Independent magazine publishers, including The Nation magazine and National Review, are protesting a new hike in postal rates that they say could bankrupt many small publications. The rates went into effect Sunday. They were based on a proposal by the nation's largest publisher, Time Warner. According to the media advocacy group Free Press, the new rules burden small publishers with higher postage rates while unfairly locking in the best rates for the largest media companies. For some small publications, the cost of postage will jump 30%. The independent magazine world had already been facing hard times. Over the past year, several publications closed down, including Clamour, Punk Planet, Satya, and Lip. In Malaysia, a prominent political blogger has been detained for possibly violating the nation's Official Secrets Act. The 27-year-old, Nathaniel Tan, has been held since Friday. Bloggers in Malaysia helped organize a vigil on Sunday and are circulating an online petition calling for his release. And the Western Shoshone Nation spiritual leader Corbin Harney is being buried today. He died last week at the age of 87. He campaigned against nuclear weapons, opposed nuclear testing on indigenous lands, and fought the federal government's attempt to place nuclear waste inside Yucca Mountain. He was the author of the book The Way It Is, One Water, One Air, One Earth. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Troy Anthony Davis, will be executed Tuesday night at 7 p.m., unless the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles commutes his sentence. The 38-year-old African-American from Savannah, Georgia, has been on death row for more than 15 years for a murder he says he did not commit. Davis was convicted in 1991 for the murder of white police officer Mark Allen McPhail. The prosecution's case rested entirely on witness testimony, but seven of the nine non-police witnesses said they were coerced by police and have since recanted their testimony. Nine witnesses have also implicated another man in the murder. Despite this powerful evidence in Davis's favor, none of it has been heard in a courtroom because of a 1996 law signed by President Clinton called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act that restricts federal reviews of state death penalty convictions. Davis's case so is also compromised because Congress voted in 1995 to eliminate funding for organizations providing legal assistance to indigent death row prisoners. The Georgia Resource Center, which was defending Davis, had its budget cut by over two-thirds, and Davis was unable to introduce the new evidence earlier. 3 weeks ago, the Supreme Court refused Davis's final request for appeal. His execution date is set for Tuesday, July 17th. His clemency hearing begins today at 9 a.m. This is the last chance that Tori Davis has to save his life. Martina Correa is Troy Davis's older sister. She joins us from Atlanta, Georgia, right before she heads into her brother's clemency hearing. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Martina.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you joining us. I know this is a very difficult time. The hearing is just about to begin in about 45 minutes. Tell us why you have spent this more than 15 years trying to save your brother.
Well, I've been spending all this time trying to save Troy because the information and the stuff that they have against him was infactual. And I knew that some of this stuff was coming out was untrue. And so we just had to try to prove it. And then when the witnesses start coming forward, when we were able to get this case investigated, the court system was still refusing to hear it. And so I've been trying so hard for all these years to get someone to listen to the information. Because when you have no gun, no gunpowder residue, and no physical evidence, and all the witnesses point to someone else, how can you still want to execute Troy and say that actual innocence doesn't matter? And that's what's happening in this case. They're saying that actual innocence doesn't matter.
Can you talk about the two jurors who have now come forward saying they want Troy's life spared?
Well, I don't know who they are, and I'm very happy that they have come forward. And I think right now they think that more jurors have actually come forward. I'm not quite sure the number. But this is information that they did not have at trial. If they had this information at trial, I don't think that they would have ever received the conviction from Troy. But there was so much hatred and animosity geared towards Troy for 2 years in the press in Savannah that it didn't matter what Troy said in the courtroom, they were out to convict him. The district attorney said they weren't going to accept anything but death. And the thing about it is, people really didn't understand the pressure that the witnesses were put under to lie against Troy. They were threatened with jail time. They were coerced. A lot of them were very young and intimidated. And a lot of them were signing statements. One gentleman signed a statement that he couldn't even read and write. So the thing about Troy is they had built this case around Troy, and they couldn't turn around. And so they really set out to kill Troy from the beginning. And it's very, very sad because it didn't show justice. But all of this information has unfolded, and it's been unfolding for years. And people have been trying to keep this information hidden. And now that it's out, they still want to execute Troy.
The night of the killing of the police officer McPhail, you were home. You were having a party.
No, actually, I was having a party the next day. I was having a dinner party the next day. But I was home that evening, because usually I work in the day and I was off in the weekends. I was in the military. I was in the United States Army. So we didn't know about this until, you know, way after this took place, the next night sometime, almost Sunday morning, is when I found out about it.
It was when you saw your brother's face flashed across the TV screen as you were having dinner?
Actually, yes. It was like Well, my mother tried to contact me to let me know what was going on, because I had no idea what was going on. And when I turned on the TV, I saw a picture that they actually took out of my mother's home. Because until then, they had no pictures of Troy or anything. And they only had the testimony of this other witness who was on the scene with a weapon. And even the person that was being attacked identified this person. So what happened was, I didn't know what was going on until my mother contacted me.
So there was no gun found. Witnesses first said it was your brother. Although, as you say now, seven of them have recanted their testimony. Can you talk about the trial itself? Can you talk about who represented your brother? And then the appeals.
Well, at trial, okay. Well, first of all, the witnesses were identifying someone else at the scene. But it wasn't until someone went into the police department with a lawyer that the finger was pointed at Troy, and that's when witness testimony started to change. But during the trial, we weren't allowed in the courtroom. Our family had to sit outside on a stone bench. We weren't even allowed to go in and support Troy. And any of our family that tried to go into courtroom, they barred us from the courtroom by putting us on the witness list and said that we had to be sequestered. But we weren't even sequestered with the rest of the witnesses. We were sat outside the courtroom. But for the courtroom was set up, it was like white and black. It was something out like right out of the 40s or 50s. The victim's family came in with armed guards and people protecting them, and our family sat on a stone bench like we were the enemy of the state. And everyone hated us, vilified us, and our family had never been in any trouble. And so Troy was not able to get a change of venue or anything, so it was very, very bad.
Interesting, in terms of the number of people who've come out to speak out on behalf of Troy, former FBI Director William Sessions has said, "It would be intolerable to execute a man without his claims of innocence ever being considered by the courts or by the executive."
Yes. And people all over the world are saying the same thing. And they're always asking this question, why doesn't actual innocence matter? I mean, if we look at the death penalty and all the mistakes that eyewitness recantations have been making, and this is just another tragic mistake. And sometimes when people are forced to say things, you know, self-preservation, when people are afraid, but people have been coming forward, and these witnesses are still afraid. They still feel threatened by what's going to happen to them by speaking up for Troy, but they still came forward to do it, but no one will listen, and they feel like they've stuck their necks out, and they're doing the right thing, but people in the court system are still ignoring them. So we're really, really trying to save Troy's life at this point.
Can you tell us a little about your younger brother? Can you tell us about Troy? He was a coach for the Police Athletic League.
Yes, we grew up in a Cloverdale called Subdivision in Savannah, and they had a sports program led by the police department called the Savannah Police Athletic League. Troy played ball with them, so did I, from age 4 to age 15, and then Troy became a junior coach with them. And our father was a former police officer. He was a deputy sheriff in Savannah that even worked in a courthouse and protected judges. He was a military man. I was in the United States Army when I grew up. And then Troy wanted to go into the Marine Corps. I had a sister who was paralyzed from the neck down. And Troy gave up going to school in the daytime and went to night school so that he can help my mother by taking care of my sister. Troy bathed her, he catheterized her, he helped her to walk again. And once our family got back on their feet, then Troy was going to go in the Marine Corps. But Troy was one of them known as a protector of the kids in the community. If kids didn't have money to buy ice cream, he would line all the kids up at the ice cream truck and buy ice cream for them. He would stop fights in the community. And that's what happened. Troy always used to stand in and try to help other people. And I think that night, if he did not try to stand in to help this homeless man that was being pistol whipped, Troy wouldn't have even been on the scene. But he tried to protect someone else, and then he got caught up in this situation.
In addition to fighting for your brother Troy Davis's life, Martina, you're fighting for your own life. You're battling cancer?
Yes, I've been battling metastatic breast cancer for 6.5 years. In 2001, I was told that I had 6 months to live. And I asked God that just give me the strength to see my son grow up and watch my brother Troy walk free. And I dedicated my life, even though I have not worked in almost 7 years due to constant chemotherapy and treatment. I volunteer in my community, and I work and do human rights work to not only help Troy, but to help other people who are facing the same situation. So my battle is more than just for Troy. My battle is for everyone to fight injustice. But I have been battling, and I am taking chemo. I took chemo last week. That's why my voice is a little tattered today.
You're a spokesperson for Cancer Awareness and Research, and your photo graces the side of a mobile cancer screening station.
Yes, my face is on the side of a big mammography van that's used to give free mammograms for indigent women in my community and the surrounding areas. And a couple of months ago, they actually put a photo of me on the Susan Coleman BMW drive for being the hometown hero for doing all this volunteer work in my community with people with cancer and underserved communities.
How did the 1996 law change your brother's chances?
Well, the 1996 laws is really attacking innocent people. And it has really tethered my brother's chances, almost giving him no chance to bring forward his new evidence. And so we're really trying to get people to understand that actual innocence will always matter. And I also want people to understand that we need to change laws. Because if we look at people that are being brought to justice for civil rights killings in the 40s and 50s, and they're 70 and 80 years old, and here it is, Troy is 38 years old, and he has a strong case of innocence, and nobody will hear it because of this anti-terrorism law.
How do you have the strength to keep going, given your own battle with cancer? And when did you last see your brother?
I saw my brother yesterday, and my strength is that we have strong family, we have a strong belief in God, and I do believe that the justice system can work if we allow it to. And I just, you know, my brother Troy is such a wonderful person that he gives me the strength to do this because he cares more about our family and our health than his own well-being. So he gives me the strength to keep doing this work, and that's what I do. And I'm going to fight. No matter what happens tomorrow, I'm going to continue my fight to prove Troy's innocence.
Martina, you're going into the parole board now. What is your message to people throughout the United States, people watching and listening around the world, and that you're going to deliver to the parole board today?
Well, I'm going to talk to them about Troy Anthony Davis and who Troy really is, and hope that they will listen to what I have to say. This is the second time that I've had to beg for my brother's life, but I'm going to do it because he deserves another chance. And I want people around the world to know that they can still send in letters to the parole board, fax letters to the parole board, asking for clemency for Troy Anthony Davis, and asking that we get a new trial for Troy Anthony Davis, because he deserves to have his innocence heard. And if these witnesses have come forward, then we deserve to understand what truly happened to Officer Mark Maffeo, and that he deserves justice as well. And I think that they dishonor his memory by not making sure the right person is being put to death.
Martina Correa, thank you very much for being with us. I know it was tough for you to come on today. In just a few minutes, she goes into the parole board. She was standing outside of its offices in Atlanta, Georgia. When we come back, we'll speak with the advocate for the Amnesty International, Southern Regional Director of the organization, who is going into the parole board hearing today. We're talking about the case of Troy Davis. Stay with us.
Good. And the mercy seat is waiting. And I think my head is burning. And in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway I told the truth. And I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting in its way, he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hands tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold. The ark of his testament is stowed. A throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire. And God is never far away. Into the mercy. horse's seat I climb. My head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway,
Johnny Cash, the mercy seat. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations. We're also broadcasting on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish and transcript and audio form at our website, democracynow.org. As we turn back to the case of Troy Davis, on death row, could be executed tomorrow, Tuesday, July 17th at 7 p.m. in Atlanta, Georgia, by lethal injection, unless the parole board decides to grant him clemency. Jared Foyer now joins us from Atlanta. He's the Southern Regional Director of Amnesty International USA, which has been actively campaigning against the imposition of the death penalty and for clemency for Troy Davis. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jared.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you for covering this very important story.
Well, thank you for being with us. You're standing right outside where the hearing will take place on the street in Atlanta, Georgia. You'll be going in a few minutes. Talk about what you see as the most significant legal issues here today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what needs to be understood is that though this case is getting exceptional attention, due in part to Martina's incredible advocacy, this is not a relatively new or unusual case. What we're dealing with here is a legal black hole that Mr. Davis fell into. During his case, because the issues of witness unreliability was not adequately noted, it was noted, but they didn't do a good job, and because some of the witnesses had not come forward with their statements until afterwards, when they had appeals in the Georgia state system, those appeals were ruled that there was a procedural, that it was procedurally defaulted because it had been dealt with already by the initial trial. And what the appeals court said is, in essence, who are we to second guess the juries? You already had your shot with the witnesses. Now, if you have anything new, we'll look at that, but the witnesses are not acceptable. And Mr. Davis has said on a number of occasions that if there was new DNA evidence, then that would be heard. But the witnesses recanting is Mr. Davis's evidence, and that will not be heard. And on a federal level, in 1996, in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombings, President Clinton, pushed by then Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which basically said that unless a death penalty case involves constitutional issues, unless there was a unconstitutional infringement of the rights of the defendant, the federal appeals court cannot hear it. And so that closed the channel for Troy Davis on a federal level, and on a state level it was shut down because the witnesses, the majority of the witnesses had not yet come forward with their recantment. And so everything was closed. And even though the compelling case for innocence exists, it can't get heard. And that's why the failsafe, and the Supreme Court has identified it as the failsafe, is the executive branch. And in Georgia, the governor has delegated that authority to the Georgia Board of Pardon and Paroles. And this morning, we're going to make our case. And we are very hopeful that they will hear it and that they will hear how compelling Mr. Davis's innocence is. But if not, this is how the death penalty works in America. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m., and the Georgia Board of Pardon and Paroles can make their decision up to 3 o'clock. And then 4 hours later, if they rule unfavorably, Mr. Davis will be killed.
One of the two witnesses who has not recanted, seven of nine have, two haven't, is Sylvester Red Coles, the principal alternative suspect, according to the defense, against whom there's new evidence implicating him as the gunman. Nine individuals have signed affidavits implicating Sylvester Coles. Where is he, Jared?
I believe that the attorneys have been looking for him. I do not believe that he has been found or that he is noted. What happened was, very shortly after the shooting, Mr. Coles went to the police with his attorney and fingered Mr. Davis. And from that point forward, all the police work and everything was focused on Mr. Davis. And Mr. Coles managed to get the spotlight off of him. And since then, he's done a very good job of keeping it off of him. But you look at the fact that there are nine witnesses who are pointing to Mr. Coles. And of those who point to Mr. Davis, seven out of the nine have recanted. One is Mr. Coles himself. And the other cannot identify the shooter, just the clothes. That's it. There's no murder weapon. There's no physical evidence. And a man's life is on the line. And it takes your breath away that our government can take someone's life based on so little evidence.
I'm looking at a piece in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It says, if Troy Anthony Davis is executed Tuesday, Tanya Johnson will be in mourning, not just because she's known Davis since they played together as children, but because she'll have to accept that she played a role in his death. It will be hard to live with myself after what I've done, she says. It will be very hard. Hard because Johnson believes Davis is an innocent man. Harder still because she says she did not tell the whole truth to police when they questioned her about the events that took place on that summer night in 1989. Fear aided her soul then, she says. She never spoke openly about the murder of Savannah police officer Mark Allen McPhail, not with her friends, not with her family. Only years later did she tell a cousin who nudged her to do the right thing and step forward. Seven of nine key witnesses who implicated Davis in McPhail's murder have recanted their testimony since the 1991 trial. Others, like Johnson, later made sworn statements that shifted the blame away from Davis. So you have this fight in the parking lot, Burger King. It's 1 a.m. Someone has, attacked a homeless man. And McPhail came as a security guard for the Burger King to help him, didn't take his gun out, and then was murdered right there. And the question was, who was the killer? Troy Davis had no record. And now the witnesses who ID'd him, fingered him, seven of the nine, are saying that they were pressured. How did the police pressure them?
I mean, what we have to talk about when we discuss the witnesses is that in some cases they were 16 years old. They had a number of children. Some of them did have prior records. And they were told that if you do not tell us what we want to hear, you will be going away to jail, or we will actually be fingering you. And the witnesses were scared out of their minds. I mean, they had a number of police who would, arrive at their house and tell them, you sign this or you're going to go to jail. One of the witnesses was given a signed statement, and he can't even read. But, there was an officer who was down, and the police really wanted to make sure that they got their suspect. And once Davis was fingered, that's the story that they went with. And that's what's so tragic here, is that everything was pushed into this box. And by the time we found out what was in the box, the federal legislation and the way that the state appeal system works is that you can't really find out what's in it. You can't hear it anymore. It's you get your one chance, and then that's it. And we have a death penalty system in this country that favors expediency over getting it right. I mean, that's the bottom line here, and that's what Mr. Davis got caught in.
What about the jurors who are coming forward? The jurors who convicted him, voted for the death penalty, now saying no, that if they had known then what they know now, they would not have convicted Troy Davis.
And that's not a new story either. You have in Texas a man by the name of Cantu who not only did the foreman of the jury say that they made a mistake, and Cantu was executed 13 years ago, but you had the district attorney who said that most likely they made a mistake and an innocent man was executed. This is not a new story. This is the status of the death penalty in the United States. And as much as Troy Davis's case is incredibly compelling and shows us, it shows us how clearly it is flawed, it is not new. And if we don't resolve it for Mr. Davis, it will be an issue for somebody else and someone else. And every week there's an execution in this country, if not every couple days. And even though support for the death penalty is an all-time low, and even though half as many people are sentenced to death now as were in 1991 when Mr. Davis was, it is still all too frequent. And so what I ask people to do is go to Amnesty's website, amnestyusa.org/Troy Davis. Again, amnestyusa.org/Troy Davis. And they can send a fax through the website, and it will go to the Georgia Board of Pardon and Paroles now. Please send it. And then after that, we should really have a long look at the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, both for itself and as an example, as an early precursor for what we've seen in this war on terror, where we curtail rights for the name of security and the name of freedom, and then it ends up having much larger consequences than could ever be imagined.
Several Congress members are going in to speak, among them Congressmember John Lewis. He'll be testifying before the parole board. We wanted him on the show today, but he said his first statement he wanted directly to the parole board. William Sessions, big advocate of the death penalty, is calling for clemency for Troy Davis, the former head of the FBI, William Sessions. Can you talk about his advocacy here?
Right. Well, that's an example of how Troy Davis's case is so extreme that it shows that you're dealing with a flawed system. And the overall goal of Amnesty USA and of most human rights advocates and people who really support human rights is that the death penalty is not an acceptable way for a humane society to treat its people. But what we really want to do is demonstrate the flaws. And even though Mr. Sessions right now might support the death penalty, and other advocates, including perhaps some of your watchers and listeners, might also support the death penalty, our hope is that this case really shows how flawed it is, because humans are flawed. And when you're dealing with emotions and you're dealing with a loss and you're dealing with anger and everything that gets tied into it, you especially, in that case, but in pretty much any case, you're not going to have all the facts. You're not going to know exactly what you're dealing with. We're a flawed species. And for us to put all our trust in this system, especially a system that favors expediency, is to lead to people being, unfortunately, executed despite their innocence.
The number of people who have been executed in Georgia, and also the biggest determinant of who gets the death penalty,
is race. 40 people have been executed in Georgia. 124 people have been exonerated, six of whom are in Georgia. So it really is a runaway train. And when we look at the issues of race, we look at the facts that 3/4 of all people who have been executed since the death penalty has been reinstated are African American. It is a system that is based on those who are most vulnerable, those who do not get that initial good defense, those who become the early suspect and are fingered by the police, get caught in it, and they don't have the resources. And we end up not only having a system where we take people's lives, which we should never do, but we have a system where those whose lives are being taken are those who are most vulnerable.
Looking at the American Bar Association statistics, among all homicides with known suspects, those suspected of killing whites are 4.56 times as likely to be sentenced to death as those who are suspected of killing blacks. Jared Foyer, as you are about to go into that board hearing right now, your final thoughts on what this board, this clemency board, this pardon and parole board can do, and why they would make a decision that is different from the Supreme Court of the United States?
They can grant clemency, and that is our hope. We believe we have, not only do we have, but it just exists, as compelling a case as you can possibly have. There is basically no evidence pointing to Mr. Davis. And our hope is that the Georgia Board of Clemency, as the failsafe, as the final arbiter, will not allow the people of Georgia and the people of America to put someone to death when there is basically nothing holding him to that crime. We're hopeful. We're going to find out very shortly. But this has been a long road, and it's going to continue long after Mr. Davis. I really hope your listeners and your watchers will send a fax on behalf of Mr. Davis. Let the Board of Pardon and Paroles know, but also look at the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and remember that all the legislation that's being passed in the wake of September 11th has much larger consequences, including for such issues as the death penalty.
Jared Foyer, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will also link to your website, Amnesty International USA's website. Jared is the Southern Regional Director of Amnesty International. He now goes into the Sloppy Floyd administrative building where the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles will have their hearing. And we will certainly update you on the broadcast tomorrow. He was standing in front of the Capitol building, which is across the street, the Sloppy Floyd Administrative Board hearing. The building sits on Martin Luther King Drive in Atlanta, Georgia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Having some hard traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been having some hard traveling way down the road. I've been having some hard traveling, hard rambling, hard gambling. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been riding them fast rattlers, I thought you knowed. I've been riding them flat wheelers way down the road. I've been riding them dead enders, blind passengers, kicking up cinders. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. Well, I've been hitting some hard rock mining, I thought you knowed. I've been leaning on a pressure drill way down the road. Hammer flying, air hose sucking, 6 foot of mud and a show been a mucking, and I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. Well, I've been hitting some hard harvesting, I thought you knowed. North Dakota to Kansas City, way down the road. Cutting out wheat and stacking out hay and trying to make about a dollar a day. And I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been working at Pittsburgh Steel, I thought you knowed. I've been pouring red hot slag way down the road. I've been blasting, I've been firing, and I've been pouring red hot iron. And I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. Well, I've been laying in a hard rock jail, I thought you knowed. I've been laying out
hard traveling by Woody Guthrie. Saturday would have been his 95th birthday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Is a stage being set for a U.S. attack on Iran? The Guardian newspaper of London is reporting the balance in the internal White House debate over Iran has reportedly shifted in favor of military action before President Bush leaves office in 18 months. The Guardian quotes what it calls a well-placed source in Washington as saying, quote, Bush is not going to leave office with Iran still in limbo. The source also said Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney did not trust any potential successors in the White House, Republican or Democrat, to deal with Iran decisively. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Democratic-led Senate unanimously passed a resolution last week, sponsored by independent Senator Joseph Lieberman, to censure Iran for complicity in the killing of U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Lieberman opened debate on the measure by saying the Senate has a, quote, choice between turning a blind eye to the murder of our troops and confronting those who are murdering them. The measure passed by a vote of 97-0. Lieberman has been leading the case in the Senate in support of a possible U.S. military strike in Iran. Last month, in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation, Lieberman said, quote, I think we've got to be prepared to take aggressive military action against the Iranians to stop them from killing Americans in Iraq. Lieberman's comments prompted one person to take action. Leslie Angeline, a member of the peace group Code Pink, decided she would go on a hunger strike until Senator Lieberman agreed to meet with her. She went to his office every day to ask for a meeting. Every day, she was refused. But she persisted. On the 22nd day of her hunger strike, Leslie was hauled out of Lieberman's office in handcuffs after she refused to leave. A photo of Leslie getting arrested appeared the next day on the front page of the Capitol Hill paper roll call. The next day, Senator Lieberman relented and granted Leslie a 5-minute meeting, for the following day under the condition she come alone and without press. The next day, the 24th day of her fast, Leslie appeared in Lieberman's office for the meeting. She wasn't alone, though. She brought with her Ali Nasri, a young Iranian who happened to be in Washington, D.C. with a group of 13 Iranians cycling around the country for peace. The senator met with both of them in his office. Leslie Angeline and Ali Nasri now join us from Washington, D.C. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Leslie, let's begin with you. Describe your meeting with the senator and all that led up to it. You fainted in his office in the midst of your fast?
Yes, I did. I was dehydrated, so I collapsed. Wasn't drinking enough water. It's very hot in Washington.
Talk about the meeting that you had with him.
Well, I went in by myself at first, and I talked to him. I made 2 points. I wanted to talk to him about the fact that the rhetoric that he's using, the statements of attacking Iran, actually is counterproductive. It causes the government to clamp down on the peace movement that's growing in Iran. And the second point I made was that he used to be a part of the SNCC in the civil rights movement in the 60s, and he worked for the humanity of the black man in the South, and I wanted him to work for diplomacy with the Iranian people. So those were the two things that I wanted to talk to him about. I wanted to encourage him to go to Iran and see for himself. The Iranian people are wonderful. They're very kind and generous. It's a very young population. 70% of the population is under the age of 30. They're just children. They want a good life. And Lieberman actually said to Ali and I, he said, the two countries in the Middle East that are that like Americans the most are Israel and Iran, and that came from Lieberman. So he knows that Iran is very friendly to Americans. They like Americans. And by making this these statements of aggression and about war, he's hurting the people who live there, the civil society that we want to reach out to the most.
You've been to Iran, Leslie?
I have. I just went in May, and I had the most amazing time. The people are so kind and generous. We fell in love with the Iranian people. I went with my boyfriend with a global exchange citizen diplomacy.
I wanted to play a clip of Senator Lieberman. He was speaking on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. It was July 1st, and he was talking about Iraq. He was talking about Iran.
I had an Arab diplomat say to me 2 weeks ago that what is happening in the Middle East today reminds him of what happened in Europe during the 1930s, when Nazi Germany began to make moves and the rest of Europe and the United States did not act quick enough to stop the Second World War. He was talking about Iran. Iran is on the move in Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and Afghanistan. And if we pull out of Iraq, Iran and al-Qaeda are the victors. And so my answer is, as long as we have a reasonable chance of success in Iraq, then I'm going to say it's worth it for us to stay, because if Iran and al-Qaeda take over Iraq, they will destabilize the entire Middle East, and they will strike at us here at home
with more
frequency and ferocity.
That was Senator Lieberman speaking to George Stephanopoulos. Ali Nasri, representative of Miles for Peace, a group of Iranian peace activists who are cycling around Europe and the United States to oppose a war in Iran. You met with Senator Lieberman. Your response to what he has to say?
Well, what is interesting is that Mr. Lieberman is using Iran, is comparing Iran to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a terrorist group. Iran is a nation. He's omitting the fact that there are 70 million Iranians, and most of them are pro-peace, and they are actually the Iranian civil society is in its first stages of development. And as we see, as I have experienced in my own life in Iran, it shows that the great majority of them, there are a lot of movements, pro-democratic movements in Iran, and none of them is comparable to al-Qaeda. So comparing al-Qaeda and Iran is completely wrong, in my view.
What is the effect of the increased pressure on Iran from the United States? I'm just looking at a poll of Iranians released by the bipartisan anti-terror group Terror Free Tomorrow. 80% of Iranians favor Iran offering full international nuclear inspections and a guarantee not to develop or possess nuclear weapons in return for outside aid. Close to 70% of Iranians also favor normal relations and trade with the U.S.
Yes. Well, as I just Iran, the Iranian civil society is a very, very pro-democratic one. There is a great student movement in Iran, and there is a feminist movement. There is a lot of human rights movements in Iran. And all of them are very fragile because they are very new. You know, the Western world has had three centuries of experience in democracy. And the civil society in the Western world has had its time to grow and to be established. But Iran is on the road toward that democracy and that civil society, the stage of the civil society. But and any statements like that, any harsh statements, any threats of war and sanctions against Iran can have a devastating effect on this new fragile civil society. And as when we talked to Mr. Lieberman, we told him that these consequences, we named him all these consequences. He seemed to agree with us on the theoretical level of our statements. If he will follow up and keep his promise, I'm not sure. I think he was sincere.
I mean, it's very interesting, this piece we read in the headlines, that in Iraq at least 80 people, the bombings that have been going on, the killings, but then the issue of Saudi Arabia, the Los Angeles Times reporting nearly half of all foreign militants targeting U.S. troops in Iraq have come from Saudi Arabia, one of Washington's closest allies in the Middle East. Of the 19,000 being held by the U.S. in Iraq, only 135 are foreign-born fighters. Half of them are Saudi. U.S. officials have so far refused to publicly criticize Saudi Arabia's role in Iraq. Meanwhile, in Washington, as we just said, the Senate has unanimously passed a resolution sponsored by Joseph Lieberman to censure not Saudi Arabia, but Iran for the complicity in killing of U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Ali, can you tell us what is the feeling of Iranians towards the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq?
Well, the Iranians are against this. Even though we have had a war with Iraq for 8 years, it's just at the humanitarian level, it is just unacceptable. I don't know what political gains can the United States have or can the world have from this invasion, because Saddam was an evil man, and him not being in power anymore is a benefit to humankind. But at the humanitarian level, it's just unacceptable. And when we see 700,000 Iraqis die, and they already have a very difficult life, the Iraqis. And it's just unacceptable for Iranians or for anyone who has a feeling for humanity. We live in 2007. We are just a click away at the age of the internet. We're just a click away from each other. In this time, we are all Iranians. We are all Americans. We are all Iraqis. As you see, Leslie has been on a hunger strike for Iran. It shows that she is just as Iranian as I am. And the attacks on Iraq is an attack on Iran, is an attack on the United States. The attack on the World Trade Center in the United States is an attack on Iran as well. And it just makes no difference anymore at this age of the globalized world, at the global village, that we just segregate countries and have the double standard in our judgment about them.
Ali Nasri, can you tell us about this Miles for Peace? Tell us what you're doing with other Iranians as you cycle the country.
Yes, Miles for Peace, we're just a group of 14 Iranian, average Iranian citizens who have decided to take actions because of the current state of the world. So we've decided to travel through Europe and the United States while carrying the message of peace and friendship of the Iranian people to other countries. And, well, this is the... in this way, we try to meet with elected representatives, we try to meet with cultural figures, religious figures, and try to build these bridges of dialogue between the civil societies. Because we believe that in this, today's world, what we need is people's diplomacy. State diplomacy has failed. The UN has been established like half a century ago, and we have more wars and atrocities and sanctions than ever before. So it shows that there's more to do than state diplomacy. We need to involve the nations. We need to involve the people and have their say in the people have to have their say in this current state of the world. And this was why we chose to embark into this difficult journey and meet with thousands of people and show the true image of Iran and also overcome some of our own prejudgments about people.
Where have you gone? Where are you headed right now?
Well, we started the journey in Italy, and then we went up to France, Germany, UK, and then we flew to the United States. We did the east and western coast of the United States. We had some meetings at the UN. We had a meeting in Chicago with a group of peace activists against the war. And we have had different events in the world.
And where are you from in Iran, your whole group of 14?
Most of us are from Tehran. And we have people from Kermanshah, a western city in Iran. And we are from different backgrounds, actually. The ages go from 22 to 58. They are students among us. They are teachers, university professors, and workers. We have tried to show a very wide range of the Iranian people as we selected the team.
Mm. Leslie, what are your plans now? Are you finished with your hunger strike?
We're starting a campaign today with Code Pink called Cities for Peace with Iran. And my boyfriend and I, Jess, will be traveling to Connecticut, and that'll be the first state where we're going to try to start cities for peace, pass resolutions in these cities, and then go to New Hampshire and travel all around the United States showing slides we took when we were in Iran of the Iranian people and talking about our experiences and hopefully getting cities to sign on to Cities for Peace with Iran.
And the Code Pink presence in Washington, painting lobbying pink, as they say. You now have a house there, the whole organization, the peace group, co-founded by Medea Benjamin, and people are continuing their activism?
Right, that's where I came. After I came back from Iran, I came to Washington, D.C., and I've been staying at the Code Pink House for this month during my hunger strike. And it's a wonderful place, and we're just a few minutes from Capitol Hill, so we walk to Congress every day, and we go to hearings, and we lobby our congresspeople, and we try to get the war to end in Iraq and to prevent a war from starting in Iran.
And how effective do you think you've been?
I think we're quite effective, and we have a lot of congresspeople and senators stopping and talking with us. The police talk with us. They ask me how I was doing on my hunger strike, and they seem concerned. So I feel like we're making progress with the people on Capitol Hill. And we're touching their hearts. We're very committed. We want peace in this world.
Leslie Angeline, I want to thank you for being with us of Code Pink and Ali Nasri. We will also link to your website at milesforpeace.org. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke. Welcome back, Mike. Shreve Hodokadoos, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Anjali Kamat, Jay Babalota, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, and Nicole Salazar, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks also to Becca Staley and Hugh Grant and John Randolph and Kieran Krug-Meadows. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.